Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Live from My Drum Room, and this truly is an epic episode. A tribute to our dear friend Freddie Gruber, legendary drum guru, and I'm joined by Jim Keltner, Vinnie Colaiuta, Steve Smith, Dave Weckl, Bruce Becker, Adam Nussbaum, David Bronson, Mark Shillman, Jay Didimo, Don Lombardi, Rob Wallace, and Colin Schofield. This is just an incredible group of drummers and friends that got together to talk about our friend Freddie. In fact, we went over 2 hours, so I've split this into two parts. This is part one, and thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. I'll see you on the other side. Once again, welcome to Live from My Drum Room. Very special show today, paying tribute to the late, great Freddie Gruber. And with me, I have an amazing panel of guests. Everybody here had some connection to Freddie. And we're going to get this show started with my illustrious panel. Please welcome Don Lombardi, Steve Smith, Bruce Becker, Dave Weckl, Mark Shillman, Jim Keltner, Jay Didimo, Rob Wallace. But wait, there's more. I have more returning champions coming.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for having us, Johnny.
Thanks for being here, Dave. It's a pleasure to see all you guys today. Thank you. I'm still looking for Vinny. Adam. There's Adam Nussbaum.
Adam.
And Vinny should be popping on in just a second. And David Bronson.
Hey, Vinny.
All right. Welcome, you guys. All right. Thank you for being here, everybody. David. It's David Bronson.
Sometimes when you get rid of us and bring us back in, it's, you know, takes a minute for the settings to kick in again.
Thanks, Vinny. As I said, I'm going to figure this thing out eventually. It's kind of like Star Trek when they beam people up and down. Sometimes.
That's what it does. Yeah. Well, meantime, you have three drum sets behind you. You want to play a solo for us or something?
Not in front of you guys.
Solo, you can't hear them.
Exactly. Yeah. Solo.
Tenor solo. 10 or 20 miles away.
Well, let's get started because I'd love to kind of start it off with Vinny. Well, first of all, I do want to thank Bruce Becker for coming up with this idea, presenting it to Rob Wallace. Rob and I speaking about it a little while back and really kind of presenting this whole concept, which is so great to remember our friend Freddie Gruber. So
yeah.
Thank you guys. And thank you all you guys for being here today.
Yeah.
It's been an honor.
Thank you.
So Vinny, I know you didn't technically study with Freddie, right?
No, I did. No, the thing is I never studied with Freddie formally or, you know, ever went over and said, listen, I want to take a lesson. I just hung out with him. You know, I don't know how much different that was than the lessons were, but I think that fundamentally they were probably long-term different because I was talking to Bruce about this and Freddie had a whole system, but then I've talked to other people that studied with him and you know, it was like very, very loose leaf, which was what my hangs with him were like. It was very loose leaf. So, you know, I would hang with him and he would just talk, you know, really abstract, very abstractly. I don't even know if that's an adverb, but I just made it up. So it is now.
It sounds good.
I have declared it. It's a Vinny vibe. It's a Vin verb. Hey, oh, what? Hey. So, you know, Freddie, I mean, for example, I'm just going to parlay this into a story just to, you know, an idea of what these hangs were like. I was at a PAS show. And I was playing, this was years ago, I was playing at a PAS show, and Freddie was there, and Jim was there, Chapin, right? So, as it turned out, they kind of latched on to me, and they were with me literally all day and all night for 12, 14 hours, I mean, a long time. Everywhere, we were like, they were just with me, everywhere. You know, even...
I think I remember this. 94, maybe?
Well, no. Do you remember the year that Steve Houghton gave a recital, a multi-percussion recital and Armand was in there. May he rest in peace. It was that year.
Okay. Maybe
we went into this theater and it was kind of dark in there. And we sat in the row behind Armand. And Steve, by that time, it was time for Steve to play timpani solo. So we started playing timpani. And, you know, he was great presentation, what he did, you know, marimbas, drum set, the whole bed, all multi-percussion. And all of a sudden we heard this noise and, you know, I'm sitting there with Freddie and Jim and we realized it was Armand. He fell asleep. He was snoring. He started snoring right in the middle of it. Like, with his head back, you know, all the way back. So you know, and also that same day, we went to this cafeteria. And so there I am with Jim and Freddie. So I see Henry Adler in the line. So I thought, great, I'm going to get a chance to meet Henry Adler. So I walk up to him, you know, standing behind him in the cafeteria line. And, you know, Jim and Freddie are probably 10 feet away and they're just standing there looking at me. And, you know, they can't hear what we're saying, but they just saw me looking at him talking and I'm going like this. And I was asking him something, right? And they saw the hands go up and down. So all of a sudden, I said, well, yo, thank you, Mr. Adler. And I turn around. No sooner than I barely shift my body to maybe about a 20-degree turn. I didn't even make, you know, if we saw it in slow motion, I was like just starting to turn. And right from behind my left shoulder, both of them were standing there. And in unison, they said, don't listen to him. Don't listen to him. Don't listen to him. And I'm like, I thought, oh, you can't write this. You can't write it. You can't. This is like, you know, vaudeville. So it was hilarious.
Yeah.
Both of them, you know, listen. So this went on all day, this kind of stuff, till eventually they ended up in my room, you know, and you know, Jim had a pad in one hand and he's playing to the pad. And meanwhile, Freddie, you know, Freddie's like, he's got a stick and he's walking around and they're completely oblivious to each other.
Yeah.
Completely. Like neither one of them were even aware that the other one was there. They're just talking out loud, you know, and they're in their own world. And you know, and Freddie's walking around going, this is this. This is dead. And you know, and it actually, and when I saw him do that, I thought, wow, he's right. He is right. That was like a huge thing for and you know, even though he was doing that kind of off the cuff, but it was really a big thing because, and I'm probably going off into a bunch of areas at once here, but I just can't help myself. So but I got it because, you know, I noticed there's a lot of ways to deal with a traditional grip, a lot of ways to slice that pie. I get it. There's a lot of ways to slice the whole hands pie, but let's just keep it on this road here. So just stick with me for a sec. So I finally realized, you know, when he said that, I realized how Tony played. And my buddy would say, yeah, Tony was locked and long. And I realized that when Freddie said that, he was actually showing. And I started realizing, wait a minute, I could use this. And then people would say to me, how can you play a backbeat so loud with traditional grip? That's how I would lock it. And it would be like a karate chop, right? So really, it's kind of like the same muscles groups and the same sort of motions were being done that way that they were this way. So you know what I'm saying? Versus they're having to be this delineation where, you know, the wrist is moving like this. So that was like a big thing. And that was like a Freddie thing. That's what I got from him. But he would say things like that every time I was around him. You know, most of the time I couldn't really piece together what he was what he was saying and sort of abstract it so that I could, you know, give it a pragmatic home like I did that time. And so, and another thing was that, you know, this is something that I saw that Bruce actually, he posted something on Instagram, and it was a clip of Freddie. And I think I'd seen this clip before. No. So anyway, Freddie, you know, because Freddie didn't really play much, and people never really saw him play. And anyway, in this clip, you know, he was sitting behind a drum kit, and he actually did hit the drums. But what he did was he was doing this kind of real jagged, kind of awkward motion stuff, trying to show how not to play. And then he suddenly said, instead, and then he did these moves and, you know, barely hitting the drums, but the way he moved his body, man, it was like watching Fred Astaire or something. It was like watching a dancer. And, you know, I was telling Bruce that it was like watching like choreography from West Side Story. And that's kind of where Freddie came from, that era. But the point that he got the point across. And so that's how he would roll, and people would hear him and see him, and he would talk and do things like that, just moving his body. And, you know, consequently, a lot of times, a lot of people would just bag on him, you know? And so I would just come back and say, you know what? You need to maybe have a rethink about your perception, your perceptive skills, because, you know, you may come at him expecting something instead of just listening to what he has to say and trying to get something out of it. And, you know, instead of putting it back on him, why don't you just pay attention? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Just pay the freaking attention. Yeah. You know, and I think a lot of people by doing that missed the boat. They used to do the same crap with me on clinics. And quite frankly, that's one of the reasons why I stopped doing them. I said to this one guy, you know, I said, listen, man, you know what? With all due respect, I'm not your circus monkey. You got plenty of guys out there who can't wait to be a circus monkey for you, but I'm not that guy. So go watch them. You want to see some guy juggling chainsaws, you know, while he's twirling his sticks, you know, and playing, you know, at 500 BPM with 1 foot, go ahead. You know, but I'm not going to do that on command, brah. You know, sorry. You know, so, you know, and the same thing applies to Freddie's, like, just listen to the guy. Because to me, you know, and now I wish I would have gone and studied formally with him, because, you know, I think I would have gotten a lot more out of it than just the hangs, because he was a conceptual guy, and his, you know, to me, it's like concept and context are everything. That's what everything flows from. If you don't have that, you got nothing. You're just an auctioneer, you know? So, mm-hmm. You know, that's why I got to tip my hat to Freddie. You know, Freddie reminds me of this guy that would teach violinists and pianists, and he was in high demand, and he didn't play either instrument. Wow. But everybody went to him because he was a great teacher. So
it's like ballerina prima donna, you know, it's like the woman that can't walk, but she could teach you how to be a ballerina.
Well, you know, okay.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So Freddie lived with us from 98 to 2006. During the summer.
Yeah.
So one of the things I got to point out to all you guys, because we sat for thousands of hours, and Freddie's concept, not that I know, because Rob will attest to this, he tried to make videos and such, but Freddie's perspective was he swam a lot. It's swimming. And Buddy and him went swimming a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at Buddy Rich and what Freddie's approach was a swimming approach of playing. He used to say, like, we would watch videos of a lot of you guys. And I remember one time, this is like in 98, I think Gary Husband had just put out his video.
Yeah.
And this is how perspective Freddie was by hearing something. We had a video thing in the kitchen, He liked being over here because Vinny, one of these days, and David, when you guys are out here, come over the house and hang anytime you want. But I got a cool house, like a Batman museum. You'll like it. Nice. But we had the video on of Gary and.
You froze, buddy.
Ah.
I think you're in and out.
Jay's got us on the edge of our seats.
Yes. Yeah.
No.
Like this. He's holding the stick like this.
Oh, there you are.
And he's hitting the drum, and it was exactly how he was sitting and how he was hitting the drum. He could hear, this is off of TV now, the tip and the sleeve, like the way it was coming down, all based on dancing. Tip, you know, heel stuff. So everything, and he used to always say that, where I'm dancing on the floor.
Yeah, well, he was a tap dancer like a lot of those guys were, right?
Right.
Yeah.
He did some dance studies. He always had that one classic dance move he'd use as an analogy to kind of speak about that. And he would say, Bruce, come to the floor, not through the floor.
right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, get there, that was basically what Freddie was all about. He was like, it was body mechanics and how everything kind of like stemmed from the core. And, you know, I remember one time when I guess, Jimmy, you came with Freddie over by Weckl, the show Weckl. And he goes to David, I could show you how to play that left hand, you know, get it down. Because it's that middle of the stick.
I'll share about the my extra story. Cash,
man. Get it in that upgrade, bro.
Hey, guys, can I say something real quick?
Yes. Yeah, Jim Keltner, yes.
You know what you just said, Jay, reminded me. Well, what you...
Oh, I'm
just,
going...
Jim Keltner was going to make a comment, so let's give the floor to Jim. Let
me follow up on what he was saying. I think I heard this, but Dave, you will remember this from Catalina's. You know, when Charlie Watts would come to town, the first thing he'd want to do is go hear one of the cats, you know, Dave, Vinny, whoever, you know, would be, you know, really entertaining, you know, and these guys' cases, like, extremely musical and wonderful and everything. So we would always go. I would drive and we'd have a great time and all. And so this one time Dave was playing at Catalina, we went, we're sitting at the table. And just, you know, watching this beautiful display of musicality on the drums, you know, and then Dave comes, he gets off the drums and he comes over to say hello. And I almost screwed this story up. Gruber, Freddie was with us, right? And says, Freddie, the first thing, like, we're all getting ready to go, Dave, that was spectacular. And Freddie, the first thing Freddie says when he sees Dave says, you know, I can help you with that left hand.
And
right? Do you remember that, Dave?
Well, to be honest with you, Jim, I remember like it was yesterday that you and Charlie came to see me play at Catalina's, man. I'll never forget that. That was, for me, that was like the president and the vice president coming to see me play. I couldn't believe it. And to be honest with you, that kind of, at that time, I mean, I'll share my story when it's my time, you know, Freddie, I don't honestly remember Freddie being there that day because at that point, I hadn't sort of committed to, and this rides on what Vinny was saying, you know, to give him a chance. Because quite honestly, I mean, in my past, when I saw Freddie coming at a NAMM show or a PAS show or whatever it was, honestly, I went the other direction. I just thought he was so full of it that I didn't want to give him the time of day, to be honest with you, because it just seemed like a bunch of jive. And I was one of those guys. I wasn't even prepared to listen, you know. And then this was probably early 90s, and I saw Steve Smith play at the Zildjian Day, I think. And I was just blown out at how well Steve was playing since the last time I had seen him. He had improved, like, you know, really, really substantially. And I said, Steve, what the hell are you doing, man? He goes, you should go see Freddie. You should check him out. You should listen to him. So now, Jim, I don't remember if, because I remember the day when Freddie and his, I don't remember him talking to me about the left hand, but at that point, but I remember him, I was at Catalina's and he was walking around with his unlit cigarette, as he always did. And he was, you know, I'd be playing, you know, and I don't know who I was there with. I don't even remember, but maybe Stern or my thing. I don't remember. But it would have been the same period. So it might have been that night. And you correct, you tell me. But I was playing and I'd be out of the corner of my eye, you know, because at the old Catalina's, there was a wall behind the stage to the kitchen and you could access the stage on either side. So I'm playing and I see Freddie looking around, you know, his legs head popping out with a cigarette. And then I'm playing this side and then I see him over on the left side. You know, I was like, what the fuck is this guy doing? You know? And so I don't know if that was the same night, you know.
Okay, I think I may have mixed up the story. The night that I was with Charlie, that was a different night. I think so.
I don't remember Freddie being with you guys, but that was that in itself was just an amazing, cool thing. You know,
well,
it was
awesome. Charlie, you know, Charlie, the way everybody knows the way Charlie was played drums, and yet he loved nothing more than to watch you and Vinny and the other cats.
Steve Smith, too.
Steve.
Yeah.
Whoever was, you know, just had advanced to that point where you guys get. He loved that. And he knew that I loved it. And that was one of my favorite things was to go with him like that. Because, you know, if you don't appreciate the art of drumming, all levels of it, then, you know what, I think that's that inhibition right there will be the you know, the undoing of your going ahead. That's the way I feel about it anyway. But I do remember distinctly the night that I was with somebody and Freddie was there and we were sitting at the table and he was holding court, you know, while you were playing. He goes, and he would explain things, and then when you came to the table, the first thing he said, I could help you with that left hand. And we all fell out. I don't remember your reaction, but I don't
remember my reaction either. I probably walked away at that time because I wasn't, I was like, what? You know, it's like, okay, probably so, but you know, and, but you know, fast forward though, you know, I took Steve Smith's advice and I gave Freddie the shot and I went to see him and, you know, set it up. Cause what he said to me that night was when we talked, I was playing and I really wasn't having a great night for whatever reason. And until the last tune I was playing, you know, okay. And I felt all right with myself. So I come off the stage and the first thing I did was apologize to Freddie. I said, man, I'm sorry. I sucked. I wasn't playing with anything. And he said, yeah, until the last tune. Right. And so he kind of finished the sentence for me. And I was like, okay, well, you know, guy, maybe he's not so jive after all. Maybe he actually can actually see what's going on. So that was the very beginning for me of going into spending time with this guy. And, you know, the first lesson was 6 hours long. Wow. And I don't think we talked about one thing drumming. So it was all the stories that I had to get out of the way first. Right. But anyway, I think
I was there for your second lesson where Freddie badgered me to come over and hang and play for you.
Yeah, one of them. I don't remember the chronological order. But
it was pretty unnerving. That's all I say. A guy had flown in from Europe, and he kept badgering me. And this is the way he laid it out. He goes, Bruce, I want you to come over and play for somebody. I go, Freddie, I'm tired. I'm jet lagging. I just flew in. I'm super tired. And he goes, no. You got to come over. I go, Freddie, I'm tired. He goes, no, come on over, man. David's here. Okay, so David, never knew you by David, right? I go, who the fuck is David? And Freddie, in his dry response, just goes, Weckle, who do you think? So he badgered me and made me come over there. It was just unnerving. But I remember we hung, you know, for about an hour and a half. And Freddie would say, do that thing, man. Do that one thing. And I just remember hanging. And you were very gracious. You said, hey, man, it looks great. asked me where I was playing. Well, I wasn't playing anywhere in LA because I was living over in Europe at the time, but that was the extent of it. But it was actually a very crucial point for me, because all that posture and gesture that I got as a kid was really now laid out on the table of the value of it. When I saw you coming, and before when I had met Steve a couple times at Freddy's, I was really like, oh, all right, because I took it for granted. All that movement stuff, I was doing that at 19. I was working, I was thinking like, okay, what kind of phrasing and how am I going to build up and get more experience and get my playing together? But that element, it was kind of a relief, because I looked back at it and went, oh, man, okay, that's a valuable asset. Didn't know that. But thank you for that, because that was a pinnacle moment for me in 90. I think it was 94 or 95 or somewhere around that time.
Yeah, I think that's the right period. Yeah, that was the whole beginning of a new realization for me. And it was kind of, again, you know, what Vinny was saying about a light bulb moment of realization. You know, I had so many of them with Freddie, you know, because for me, I didn't learn much about wrist movements, you know, not from a teacher. You know, it was all kind of just, okay, this is how you do it. And, you know, Jim Petersack was responsible for all my finger control stuff that I was talking about in my early videos. You know, I wasn't even talking about wrist movement, you know, the most basic stroke on the drums. It's like, I kind of skipped that, you know, because I was never taught anything about it, you know, until Freddie. And, you know, and it was kind of like a big deal of, you know, the whole thing that he was referring to when he said to me, he said, you're in the zone some of the time. He said, I can get you there all the time. And I said, okay. And what that translated for me in the light bulb moment, which I was kicking myself that I didn't go see him or at least understand this earlier, at least for my approach that I feel has kind of prolonged and saved my career. Actually, I was in tough spots with neck freezing and stuff freezing up. And this was 25 years ago. And so, you know, like Jim said, I'm probably in better playing shape now than I was when I was in my 30s. So, and a lot of it's due to what Freddie told me and showed me. And that was, you know, the zone for him translated to me as the simple difference, A, of front of the hand priority versus middle of the hand priority is what I call it. It's, you know, just where fulcrum exists between thumb and middle finger versus thumb and index finger, and playing more from the back of the hand. And this was something that I had not ever heard of or known. And then his B, the second thing that was so profound for me was the laws of physics, action, reaction. And it was all about the bounce and the utilizing the stick's energy to help me play. And I was, the first time I went home and realized that in order to make any of this work, I had to tear down the entire drum set, start over, so that ergonomically positioning made more sense for traditional, because that was my focus. I was committing. I had messed around with match grip before, and I was running into trouble with just the priority grip to concentrate on practicing. And so I made a decision, it was going to be traditional, and that's why I set up with the kind of wacky tilts and angles. That wasn't Freddie, that was me deciding and analyzing myself that in order to do what he was talking about, I have to be in a position where the body movements, like Bruce is talking about, all the motions and the movements and all that natural stuff, because those were the two words he would use all the time with me, was relaxation and natural movements, you know. And the one thing that he always used to like to say was, you know, most people spend their whole life in their own way, you know, meaning, you know, that they're fighting themselves, you know, even coming down to a basic setup situation where it's creating unnatural body movements. So those are the profound moments for me in the light bulb. It's like, holy cow, you know, this ability to come up and out of the kit, you know, focusing and left hand, yes, because back then I was still back on the back of the stick. Where I picked it up from Gad and Erskine and everybody else. It was in Vinny too, actually, when I saw him play the first time. you know, we were all playing from the back of the stick, and that was great for producing a, you know, consistent backbeat. Steve Smith too, for, you know, in the early days, we were all doing that, you know.
Yep.
So I went in there and I had my red sticks, and he says, "Give me the stick." And I gave him the stick, and he said, "Ah, the first thing you're going to do is change these sticks." I said, "Why?" He goes, "Ah, you'll figure it out." That was his favorite thing to say to me. You know, did you guys ever learn this exercise? You ever learn this one where it would hold like this and it pulled up this way?
Yes. That was the first.
Learn that one?
First step.
Learn that one? Yeah. I said, "What's that for, Freddie?" He goes, "Yeah, you figure it out." Everything was, "Yeah, you'll figure it out." You know.
Hey, Dave.
Sorry, Vinny, what did you say?
That's very wise.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I did go to
an Aikido class, right? There's this martial art called Aikido, right? And you see these guys, the guy goes and demonstrates it. The teacher, he takes a partner and he demonstrates a movement silently once, maybe twice. Then it's like, go ahead and do it. I'm not going to say a word. I'm going to show you once and then you figure it out. Just do it.
Yep.
Then I'll go around to each group of people in pairs, because that's just the nature of it. And just correct people of various movements. But there's just no pandering and talking and yakety yakety yak. Just, you know, one little demonstration and then figure it out. Kind of like when we had to go see people play. It was like, well, we didn't have YouTube or any of that. We'd watch the set. When the set was over, it's like, how much did you retain?
Yeah.
Did you get it or you didn't? That was it. It's gone now. You know?
Yep.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
Hey, guys.
Years ago, Vinny and I, we hung out and we talked about, you know, the videos that are coming out, the kids that are learning how to play and are copying everybody's favorite drummer. And you know, music is listening. And Lenny White and I are friends. And Lenny's over the house. I was showing this one guy. He's doing, like, you know, calisthenics with flipping the sticks. He's doing this. But Lenny goes, "Close your eyes. What's happening?" And all you heard was boom, chap, boom, chap. And it's all this other stuff is going on. And you just heard like this backbeat going on. He goes, "He's not doing much, is he?" So, you know, maybe it's well and good. You know, it's fireworks. It's fun to look at. But, and it's not to say, you know, but that's the kind of world we live in. It's like we need to have that visual thing and the ear thing and the technique and an educated audience. It's kind of, you know, they bring it. But, you know, David and Vinny and all you guys, you have a certain way of approaching the drums that makes it your own. And that's a beautiful thing. That's what you want to have. You want to have a character of when you're playing, somebody identifies you with that instrument and makes it your own of what it is. You know?
And depending on what you do, if you're going to be an artist, your own artist, or if you're going to be a session guy, you also have to then be able to do that, but yet retain some transparency. You know, if you're going to be a session guy.
Well, you know, it's funny because if you look at the session guy thing, because David studied with Gary Chester, and Gary Chester was like the East Coast version of Hal Blaine. Yeah. And when I read the article that David wrote about Gruber, and to bring Freddie back into the mix here, is when I read that article that he studied with Freddie Gruber, and then I did some research, I'm going, wow, he sounds almost like grovelly like Gary Chester, because I went up to Gary Chester's place. And Gary saw this video that I made, and it was like I was like doing hi-hat stuff back in the early mid-80s. And I did this video at a studio, and he saw the video, and he was like, "Hey, that's guy's playing like my New Breed book." And I knew that David was studying with him. But Gary, I don't know if you guys know this, but Gary was responsible for Steve Gadd getting studio work back in the early 70s or late 60s, because when he moved to New York, he obviously wanted to do session work. He lived with Tony Levin, and Gary had a bad back, so he couldn't do like a lot of sessions. And that's how Steve got the gig. And he originally was going to be the drummer for Return to Forever. And he, if you listen to go online, you could hear him playing Hymn of the Seventh Galaxy with Mongo Santa Maria playing percussion. And it's a whole different mix of what Lenny did and what. So if when you hear it, you go, wow, it sounds like Steve. But, you know, we all love how Lenny approached that stuff, because it was sort of like on a Tony Williams factor. And it's kind of wild, because if it's all like it's like a thread going through a piece of material. You know, what is material anyway? It's a bunch of threads, you know? So Freddie kind of like tried to always translate anything to some metaphoric kind of innuendo, and he would try to bring that into the conversation or into the vision of what you're doing. Bruce, did he have that picture of Don Ellis?
Yes.
Yeah. He taught Don Ellis.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what, you know, back in the day, in the early days, because I started with Freddie around 77. His whole approach was so methodical. I pulled out my old Buddy Rich book, which is ripped to shreds, and I was going through that and the Roy Burns, Lou Mallon book, and it was astounding at the detail. He'd always tell me, Bruce, I took an insurance policy out on you, man. You know, so the turns and everything with the pickups. Don would remember the pickups and all that stuff and the setup. I mean, everything was meticulously put together to make sure it all worked. And at that time, I would say, because it's before he sold his little house on Etiwanda, that was probably the leanest and cleanest Freddie was. His house was relatively clean and in order. I know that you guys who went to the Zelza house would know otherwise. That house was a little cracker box.
Yeah, the rugs were like walking on like, you know, craters.
Yeah. Oh, you know.
He had that DW kit with all the clothes hanging on the wall.
Yeah. Oh, he had the clothes racks all over.
Did you stay at his house?
Oh, I used to house it for him, man. I was the only guy he'd give a drum key to because he didn't trust anybody, and I'd badger him. Because when I moved to Europe, he was so heartbroken that he was on my doorstep 2 months later to hang with me, and we did about four trips. It's where I met Adam one of those times at the Frankfurt Music Fair, and then we'd do the drum festival in Koblenz. But back what I wanted to say was that his approach back when he was on Etiwanda was pretty clean and mean. I want to say he was still late. He still started late. You could show up and there'd be like two guys on the couch and a guy on the drum throne. And, you know, you'd walk in and go, Bruce, go down to the seafood broiler, you know, that whole thing. And get me the white chowder. I can't drink the red chowders out, man. It gives me, you know, stomach ache. And then with the bread and how many butters to get and all that stuff. But I know that what he was doing was always a character analysis. He wanted to see how attentive and how you could listen to what he wanted to put forward. So going back to like the listening thing, what you were saying, Vinny, about saying it like once or twice and getting the guy to get it. Yeah. Well, you know, Freddie dealt with a large cast of characters and would always, you know, kind of dial into who they were and was masterful at his ear listening to who that guy was, his attentiveness to that person. He had a great... like a cartoon rendition in his bathroom on Etiwanda. I'm sure, Don, you remember this, with all these naked people in line walking around. There was about like six or seven lines of people, about 14 or 15, you know, all various body sizes and all that stuff. And at the bottom caption was like, don't laugh, you're in the picture too. but Freddie was good at like really listening. I remember listening to the Lyle Mays record, and there's one track that Steve Gadd's on. And all of a sudden, he perked up and he goes, Jesus Christ, who is that? You know, it's just like his ear to really dial into what was going on was just amazing. I was always astounded at his ear. I just want to tell a story that includes Adam Newsbaum.
Hey, Bruce, can you hold that story for one second?
Sure. Yes, sir.
Just because Mark's going to have to leave, I think, in about 5 minutes. And I want to bring Mr. Mark Shulman in just before he has to run off. And then we'll come back to that. So, Mark.
You're so kind, and I'm so honored. I'm going to be very, very quick because I've thought about what I want to say. And it's sort of parlays off of what Dave was talking about, which is let the stick do the work. I feel like because, you know, my career is based on playing large motions in very large venues with pop artists. And I believe that Freddie basically saved my body. I mean, I'm a 62-year-old man now. I can still play. Everything works. It all works great. I started studying with Freddie when I was 17 because of Bruce. I've known Bruce since elementary school. And Bruce is like, you got to study with this guy. So I go and I start studying with Freddie. And I'm this cocky 17-year-old kid just wanting to play every chop I knew, everything I knew. And here he is, you know, getting me in the Burns and Mallon book and the Buddy Rich book. And I'm doing that, you know, all of these basic exercises really, really slowly. And he was humbling me. And one of the two critical things I learned from Freddie from a technical standpoint that I really believe were life saving for me is one is that the Hammond is an acoustic chamber. Because I was always tight, you know, I was always tight. You're a kid, you're tight. And I was playing rock and roll, and I was always just, even trying to play jazz or trying to play swing, I was tight. He was the one that made me realize it's an acoustic chamber. So let it open up and let it breathe. And he also was the one that that taught me to let the stick do the work. When I'm playing the bass drum, let the beater do the work. So I learned that I could use a lot of motion and I wouldn't need to use the muscle. And that became such a profound lifesaver for me. So I studied with him for a few, tell so many Freddie stories about him, what to affirm what Bruce said, that I believe he was testing us to see how much detail, how much we were paying attention to detail. When he would send me, he goes, okay, Mark, you need to go get me a roll. I want the poppy seed roll. You give me 17 cents. He said, don't give me a dried out one. And you do the same thing. Yeah, talk to the lady on the right. And I think he really wanted to make sure we were paying attention to detail. So fast forward, I hadn't studied with Freddie, hadn't seen him in years. I come back, I want to do a refresher course. I'm in the other room across the house. He's in the bathroom. I'm warming up on the practice pad. He says, I can hear it from here. You're choking the stick. What about the acoustic chamber? And that's when I realized this guy puts his money where his mouth is. This guy is a bloody genius, and he pays attention to every little detail.
He was
life-changing for me, still is. So, because I know there's so many stories to tell, and I got to bail out of here in a couple minutes, but I just thought those were very, very pertinent.
Because Jimmy Chapin also, we hung out, Rob knows, because the Modern Drummer Festival over here in New Jersey. And I asked Jimmy Chapin one day, I go, can you explain, like, you and Freddie Gruber, I had Freddie and them together. I said, back in the day, what would you two guys be? And he looked at me and he goes, well, this is Jimmy now. Jimmy goes, well, Jay, you know, I would be Weckl and Freddie Gruber would be Vinny. That's what he said.
I'm not sure what that means, but
I think what it meant that, you know, being like a drummer thinker or player, I didn't know what that meant anyway, but I said, what would you be? And then all of a sudden, that's what he used as an example. But yeah, that's a great shot.
Mark, along
I got one with me with Freddie Krueger head with him.
Mark, along with what you said, one of Freddie's comments used to always be, you don't hold the stick in your hand, you house it.
Great. Exactly. So perfect. I love that photo, by the way. That must have been, what, circa 15 years ago? What do you think, Bruce?
Yeah, that's about, I think, early 2000, somewhere around 2005 or 6, I think.
Yeah, probably 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Freddie didn't change much over the years. It's pretty amazing looking at pictures. He kind of looked the same. I met him in 86 working for Don, and his hair might have got a little grayer, but, you know, he never gained any weight, obviously. He probably got thinner, actually. But the guy was pretty consistent.
His character. You know, I just want to say I'm really thrilled to be here with you guys, man. I'm going to bail out, too. But one last thing, man, I want to say is just, you know, he was a character, and God bless him for that. I think we need more characters. You know, just allowing yourself to be one in this day and age and just be accepted for it, because – there's a lot of wisdom in that, too. So, man, I'm learning a lot from you guys, and I wish I could hang out.
I got to jump in and just say something. Freddie was a one in a row.
Amen. Yeah.
Well, Freddie was a master storyteller and a master of metaphors. And I think that's why there was always something you could apply. Everything he would, you know. Everything had a metaphor to it. So anyway, everybody, thank you so much. I'm so grateful to be in your company and to be able to honor Freddie. What a fantastic experience. Have so much fun. I can't wait to see the whole thing.
Yeah, Mark, I'll send it to you when it's all ready to go. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, sir. Cheers.
Come over to the house and play the drums.
Yeah.
Vinny, if you can hang, you got to take off right now. Because I wanted to address, like you said, you know, you got to hang with Freddie and you wondered what it would be like to have a lesson with Freddie, mm-hmm. you know, if it was similar.
Yeah.
And it was different. It was really different. Like in the hang was the character, you know, like the, and like Dave said earlier, sometimes, you know, people would want to head the other way. And in fact, Johnny, there was Steve Gadd and Armin Zildjian, when they were inducted into the Zildjian Hall of Fame, and Vinny, you were there playing with the band for Steve. Johnny assigned Freddie to me.
That's right.
To make sure he didn't totally dominate every conversation that happened when a group of people gathered together, you know, during, it was like a 2-day event. So, you know, I was his caretaker to just like really occupy Freddie to, you know, so he didn't dominate all these other situations.
But you had the muzzle.
So, but you know, just to tell my story is that I got a call from Peter Erskine, and Peter's, and this is something like 89 or 90. And Peter said, "Do you know Freddie Gruber?" And I says, "No, I never heard of him." And he goes, "But he's looking for you." I says, "What do you mean?" He goes, "I guess one of Freddie's students brought him my video, you know, Steve Smith Part One, and you know, and I'm playing, holding the, like, you know, the stick in way in the back." And he said, "I can help this guy get out of his own way." And he was 100% correct. But
yeah, no, I just love it.
Yeah. But he was, yeah, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, fixing Dave's left hand. It was like, that's, you know, that was, yeah, the concept. He says, like, you know, so he was looking for me. And I met him through Ian Wallace at a Zildjian, yeah, day. I think it was a Zildjian day or one of those Buddy Rich days. It was probably 1990 in New York, you know, so, and we got to my room with a large entourage of people, like, you know, Freddie, I met him, I've heard, you know, I know you're looking for me. And he, you know, pulled out a pad and there's like 11 people standing around.
I remember, says, this, yeah.
He,
yeah,
says, play a press roll. You know, so I picked up the sticks like this, you know, and I played a press roll for about 2 seconds, and he just slammed the tips of the sticks into the pad. And then he just went to just, he just adjusted my balance point. You know, and he says, "Okay, you know, now try it." And of course, it was much easier, and I could play a much better role. So, and that was like a moment. Okay, I'm gonna take this guy seriously. So then I started to go to lessons, and it would be something like 2 or 3 times a year over the course of 3 or 4 years, and we'd spend like 8 hours there, but in reality, maybe 2 hours on the kit. You know, 2 hours with the sticks. And, but it was extremely meticulous what would happen in the lesson, because he had incredible powers of observation, like everyone's saying. And so what he would focus on wasn't like what Bruce is talking about, like a system. It was like the next piece of the puzzle, is the way he called it, to get you with the technique that you're currently using to the next step of making it easier to play.
Yeah, and that was the zone yeah, thing for me.
So one step at a time. And so this is, you know, and that could be simply like one of the things is just not hitting the drum, but allowing the stick to drop. Like it would be so soft. It would be just this. It's just like letting the hand open up, letting the stick drop. And letting the bass drum beater just touch the head and splashing the hat. So one of the first things he said is it all starts with one good note. And one good note is just like taking a breath, letting each stick drop, letting the bass drum beater hit the head, letting the hi-hat cymbal splash, and creating one note, no flam, bottom coming from the underneath, and then a very beautiful sound on the cymbal and on the snare and on the hi-hat. So it had to start with one note that had bottom, had no flam, had a real nice tone, which I loved. I loved that idea. It expanded my dynamic range incredibly that way, to go be able to play triple pianissimo with ease as well. It was easy to play loud. In fact, you know, so, but that, and then the kind of detail we would get in with the left hand was to perfect the way the motions I was currently using. And once I got those, he introduced two other ways to play traditional grip. So in he had like three different motions, three different ways to play traditional grip. Outside, where it was more like molar, like this. And then this way, where the stick would travel this direction. And then like reverse, sort of the opposite of molar. Like, so during that course, I developed three different ways to play traditional grip. And then, you know, various embouchures and sounds out of the ride cymbal and the constant release bass drum technique. We really got deeply into the bass drum technique as well. So he was the only teacher that I've been to that was completely holistic, meaning four limbs, swing pulse. He brought it right back to, you know, he would talk about Charlie Hayden's bass feel and playing with this kind of swing pulse. So everything made sense. It was not just a guy on with sticks on a pad. And so over the course of like that 3 or 4 years, I went through like various steps of learning this technique, another technique, but always hands and feet together. Everything quite holistic, but specifically for me, specifically, even though there were universal principles of motion, as he used to call them, but they were what I needed at the time to take one step forward and then another step forward till the point, like one of the first thing he said to me when I got there is like, are you serious? How serious are you? And I said, I'm serious. And he goes, no. And then he'd ask me again and again, like, well, meaning, are you willing to really break it down? You know, break down your technique, look at it under a microscope and do the work to perfect it. And I said, yeah. And then we got into it. And he said, when somebody asks you, how did you play that? Your answer is going to be easily. That's right. Easy. And that's when, you know, maybe a couple of years later, Dave saw me play and I told him I was studying with Freddie. And I remember, Dave, you said something. You mean that crazy old guy really knows what he's talking about?
something to that effect.
Right. I said, yeah, he does. He knows what he's talking about. Definitely.
Beautifully and eloquently said, man. That was an amazing synopsis of a lot of stuff. So thank you for that.
I wanted to address that because it really was a different experience to be in the room with him and get him focused. And I would have to do that because if I didn't say, Freddie, this is great. You know, we're talking about your life insurance and then, you know, but let's go in the room and sit for and play. And so then we did.
Yeah.
We did.
Can I just say really quick before Vinny runs too, but, and when I said that, Steve, about, you know, sort of babysitting Freddie, it was out of obvious love and respect for Freddie, but it was to make sure we got the photos with, you know, the past honorees, Elvin and Max and Roy and Louie were there and they all knew Freddie and, you know, I just envisioned Freddie wandering into a photo with, you know, we were just trying to.
Absolutely.
Believe me, John, we all get it. Don't worry about it.
I know and it was a pleasure and no need to, you know, but I appreciate that, Johnny, but it was a good assignment and I had a great time. So
yeah. That's great, man.
Yeah.
Guys, man, it's been a real thrill. Freddie, it's been a real honor, man. And I'm going to love you and leave you, man.
Okay.
All right. See you, Vinny.
Take care, Vinny.
Vinny, thank you so much for being here, Vinny.
Thanks, man.
Love you, brother. Yeah, all right.
Love you back.
Stay well.
See you soon, Vinny. All right. Styx Lombardi, you were about to say something.
Once your buddy introduced Freddie from the bandstand saying, and there's a great drummer in the audience, if you'd ever stop playing on practice pads, Freddie Gruber. That was his introduction to Freddie.
Wow.
Freddie used to tell me all the time, he'd say, Bruce, you got to play on real drums. And then you'd go to his house. He had those little muted, like, stretch bands over his cymbals, all the practice pads, and the surgical tubing on the sticks and the stick tips. And I go, wait a minute, what do you mean you got to play on real drums? What are you doing? You know, he'd always be with those surgical tubing sticks and everything. But he'd always command, like, Bruce, play on real drums, man. That was his line.
Yeah.
It was continuously. Well,
I just want to share really quickly. There's a somewhat infamous PASIC, and I want to say that I've narrowed it down to Atlanta, 1994, where Freddie was doing a master class. And I know Vinny's gone now, but he was at that PASIC. Steve, I don't know, or Dave, if you were there or not, but no. But he had a slot, you know, in the PASIC that year to do a 50-minute master class. And Jim Coffin, myself, Armin, Lenny, you know, the whole gang, we were all there to watch Freddie. And it was sort of a classic moment where we had a drum set, DW drum set set up, and Freddie was sitting in a chair, and he, you know, time's going by, and as he's talking, and he's imparting some good information, but he's really just talking. And I remember also, I'll back up a second, having breakfast with him, and me being the stressed out, you know, watching the clock kind of guy that I am, I'm going, Freddie, your clinic, your masterclass is like 20 minutes, and he's just ordering his eggs. And I said, we got to get your drums, you know, I think we'd have the drums set up or something. So anyway, we get to the room, and we go in there, and here comes Colin Schofield. And so he's chatting, and the clock's running out. And finally, Armin and Lenny, I think, are yelling, play, play. And he never did. And he never did play. So here's the payoff to the story. A couple of years later at Montreal Drum Fest, rest his soul, Ralph Angelillo, who we lost recently, could verify and corroborate this story. But Freddie was there again to do a masterclass. And it was in, if anybody's ever played that festival, Dave, I know you have, and I know Steve has. There's that room downstairs where you'd get your drums set up. Do you remember there was like that prep room where everybody'd get their gear together? So Ralph had carved out a little section in that room for Freddie's masterclass. And it was at like 5 or 6 o'clock after the day's event had ended. And a whole bunch of people stuck around because he's Freddie Gruber. And by that time, he was legendary. He was Dave Weckl and Steve Smith's teacher. And, you know, like he had a big reputation. And I want to say Steve Edelson had one of those, I'm mentioning all these people. Steve Edelson, rest his soul. One of those, it was a Remo Mondo set. Do you remember those? They had those like almost like bongo type heads on them.
Yes.
So Freddie's sitting down, and I think he just liked the way it felt. And all of a sudden, he's playing some serious shit on these drums. And he was feeling good. And like everything was gelling. You know what I mean? That was the only thing I could explain it is that he was like, he was started off showing a few things and demonstrating a few things. And then I think he was even going like, man, did I just do that? And then all of a sudden, he's going for it. And he's playing some great shit. So, of course, we had a great dinner that night at the Italian restaurant up the street. And he said to me probably 100 times, when you get back, you tell Armin and Letty that I played and that how great a job I did. I said, Freddie, you can bet I will. I mean, I absolutely will. But it was so, he was so happy. And it made me so happy to see him. You know, I think he felt somewhat redeemed because I think he felt like, you know, he wanted to show that he really could play the things that he talked about.
John, now, was that pre or post after he fell down the steps?
Those are my steps he fell down.
I don't know.
Oh, was it your steps that he fell down?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it would have been maybe the later
90s. That's a story like, you got to tell everybody, that one.
Would have been like 90, maybe 96 or 97, maybe, something like that.
And it was after, right, Bruce?
I'll tell you that story, and it kind of ties in with Jim Keltner there. Freddie came over to my house about 2 months after I moved to Belgium in 92. I picked him up. We hung out for, I don't know, about a week or so or 8 days, and he was scheduled to go to London to hang out with the guy that would book Buddy at Ronnie Scott's. And he had it all worked out. We got tickets for him, you know, at the Netherlands side of things for a train and all this stuff. That's even a longer story. But so after that 8 days of us traveling around, we went to Germany to a couple of shops. We went down to Austria to a school that I eventually taught at in Vienna. He was just bugged. One, he was having trouble like melding with the cultural differences from Austria and from Germany and all that stuff. I remember sitting in a pub with him, and he was with my brother and I, and he looked at this guy and he goes, "That's Konrad Adenauer," who was a long dead prime minister for Germany after the war. And I go, "Freddie, he's been dead since like the 60s. No, that's him. Anyway, he was getting really bugged about stuff. I don't know what was really chafing him, but we were sitting down finally in my pad in Antwerp, and we were listening to Bill Evans. I was like really on a Bill Evans kick back then. So we're listening to Explorations, and it's like got Freddie really mellow, and he was in that stage. I could get him really mellow and get him to talk. And one of the guys in the house had some hash, and we were smoking some hash. And Freddie had this whole thing with the glass on the pin with the hash, and you know, and letting the glass fill up. Anyway, got him really relaxed. We're listening to Bill Evans, and finally, I'm out of gas. I got to go. And my brother and I went to bed. Our friend Roger, who was one of the housemates there, he went to bed. Freddie was left by himself, and I said, Freddie, when you go to the bathroom, you walk down the hall. Here's a light on this end. You turn that on. It's on a timer. Okay. Then you go into the bathroom and there's a light switch right out the door. Okay. If anybody knew Freddie's bathroom habits, he'd go in and you wouldn't see him for like 45 minutes. He'd be combing every hair and trimming stuff. Whatever he was doing, he was in the bathroom. It was about 3 or 3:30 in the morning. He steps out of the door, apparently, and he can't find the light switch for the time switch for the light. He takes one step forward, and as, you know, Bugs Bunny would have said, that next step was a Lulu. He fell straight down my stairs, and So I'm kind of in this sleepy haze, and I hear this, like, bap, 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 bap. And I get up, and I look at my brother, go, what was that? And then within 1 second, all you hear is, Jesus Christ, God damn it, ah. Jesus Christ. So we come running out, and my brother's like freaking out. He's like, Freddie, are you okay? Okay, at the end of it, all that guy did, luckily, was just dislocate his shoulder. Okay, so we had him in a sling. I remember when I brought him home from the hospital, took off the sling, he's like, put a stick in my hand. No, my brother was like complying with him, and I'm like looking at him going, get that fucking stick out of your hand and put that sling back on. But as a result, Jim Keltner was playing with a band, Little Village, great band, Jimmy, love it. And we're in Brussels, and we tried to get to you and call you to come down there. Well, Freddie pulled his Freddie. We go down to the theater. It was me and my brother and I think my friend Roger. And we show up, and Freddie goes to the ticket guy. So my student, he's playing here, and he's in the band, and I just saw him in New York. He's got the sling on, and he's giving this whole rap. And, of course, this woman just goes like, go in and just take any seat towards the back. There's some open seats. Go right ahead in there. So we get in, we sit, we watch Jimmy play. It was fucking great. And we tried to make it down to the stage, but of course, when the theater was letting out, you know, everybody's coming up the passways through the hall, the corridors. And we're kind of fighting people, and Freddie's got his arm. I didn't want him to get a knock his arm. So we run down there, and apparently Jim had already left. But I did get a call the next day from Mr. Keltner here, who said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I missed you guys," you know. And I told him what had happened. I don't know if Freddie. I don't remember Freddie being there when you called, but I just spoke with you and told you what had happened. And you said, "I'm really sorry, I missed you guys," and that was kind of the extent of it. But he fell down those stairs and absolutely was, you know, amazingly resilient enough not to break anything. And then later on, made me call up John Good at DW Collect Call. Because he's, how am I going to pay for all this? And I'm like, well, okay. He puts me on. He's pushing me. You got to call John Good. So I'm like, John, I'm sitting here with Freddie. He fell down the stairs, and he's worried about the health insurance and coverage. And John's like, just don't worry about it. Tell him he'll be covered. Don't worry about it. But that was the notorious falling down the stairs story. And then I had to put up with him, so to speak, for another 5 or 6 days. And he was pretty agitated because he'd fallen down. Then he had to cancel this whole trip to London, which was a drag for him. You know, he'd made all these plans. He continued to make his other plans, which were down to Nice to do the jazz festival to hook up with Louis Belson. He had hooked up with Cindy, so I had to house both of them for about 4 or 5 days. And we were able to actually go, and we crashed the North Sea Jazz Festival. So we were there for like 2 days as well. It was pretty cool. Wow. But that was the Freddie falling down the stairs story.
I want to welcome. Thank you for that. I want to welcome Colin Schofield, first of all.
Colin,
I'm going to get to you in a minute because we touched on Ian Wallace, and I know you want to share some what you and I remember, which was Ian studying with Freddie really early on. But Don, I know you're tight on time, right? You have about 10 more minutes or so.
Yeah, I've got to be on. in my time, a 1 o'clock call. So I can hang for another half hour and then I'll have
to. I was going to say, in 10 minutes, you could probably say everything you have to say about Freddie, probably, right? And still have 5 minutes left over because you didn't know him that well.
Exactly. And everybody chime in if you want. I mean, going along with what everybody said, there's the personal, unbelievable side of Freddie's life story, too. Just being out on the street at 16 in New York, taking his own life in his hands and doing what you do in order to try and make it in the way he did. And from the stories he would tell about his youth, he didn't change at all, I think, until the day he died. You know, he was fearless from the very beginning. And that was one of the things I think it made him so unique. I mean, the stories you guys tell, you're the greatest drummers in the world, legends that are on this Zoom here call with us. And for somebody to even have the nerve to go up and say, I can help you do something because you're doing something that everybody else thinks is unbelievable in the first place, is part of Freddie's gift. He was just fearless at every level, whether he was dealing with a realtor to sell his house for three times more than the appraised value, or the story of hitting the same person. If this is unbelievable, at three different parts of the United States in a car accident. And I actually got him on film explaining that, you know, with the name of the person for the first who he actually hit in New York, in Las Vegas, and in Florida. And the guy was fairly well connected. And I know when I went with Freddie to his accountant and he wanted to buy the house, he wanted to get a loan. He had a big down payment. He wanted to get a loan for it. The accountant is, Freddie, you don't have a social security number. You can't. Nobody knows you're even alive. Said, well, I was worried about this guy. I got in an accident with him. I didn't want him to find me when I came out here to L.A. And so finally he got to. But that part of his life is another whole, as amazing a story as we know him as his musical story. It was 65, late 66 when I started studying with him. Terry Gibbs had introduced me to him. Terry was taking care of him when he first came out here to L.A. We just got out of UCLA rehab. And Terry Gibbs, who had known him from the New York days, and Frank DeVito.
Julius Gubenko?
Yep, there you go.
Gubenko.
And Frank DeVito, who knew him from the New York days, too, told me a lot of stories of him back in New York and what he was doing in those days as part of his lifestyle, which, of course, he had a big addiction issue, which was, you know, something that kind of, I think, framed his life in a lot of ways that it went, which is why he wasn't out there playing as much as we would think of him as a player. And on that note, when Vinny was talking about people ragging on Freddie, because I do see it on socials, that where is this playing? Where is this playing? Where is this playing? Well, I know Vinny took a couple lessons from Murray Spivak, who you don't have any really archives of him as a drummer, but there's a lot of great teachers that are good drummers that are good teachers, some of that are both. But I hate to see those comments. I mean, yeah. I get on socials because I don't have time for all those comments. But, you know, I think we all agree that it's not, from what you guys are saying, it adds so much validity to the fact that the knowledge somebody has is what you all got from Freddie. Whether he experienced it personally or not, he experienced it in one visual way or visceral way or not by seeing what other drummers were doing. But in 65, 66, Burley Drummond and Mike Beard were on the same day as me. I was at 3 o'clock. They were at 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock, and I'd get there at three. And of course he hadn't started with either of them yet, which is why it's because we would hang out. And that was Monday. I remember exactly, because it was my night off, and I would probably end up at Freddie's until 11 or 12 that night, which was not great for my first marriage, because that was my one night off and I never got home because I was at Freddie's. And I then rented the house behind Freddie for about a year and a half and split that rent with Alan Kaplan, who's a studio trombone player in his later life. That was just a way. I didn't live there because I still had a house in Santa Monica, but I would hang out there on occasion. And that's when, you all know, Bruce, Freddie got going, you know, from 1 to 4 in the morning is when you'd probably get the major.
Those were the best times, the 1 to 4 in the morning, when you got him chilled out, when he could sort of just, he'd always say to me at 1 in the morning or 2 in the morning, he'd go, Bruce, do you hear that? I go, no. What are you talking about? He goes, exactly.
Happening.
I think that's Freddie. He's having the last word, as usual.
Sabotaging our event.
What I was saying, and back in those days, my experience with Freddie was him breaking down systematically, as Bruce said he was, even in 10 years after that, Buddy's technique. As being younger than Buddy in New York and hanging out with him to some degree, having some fallout with him, which lasted about 15 years. They didn't talk to each other at all until Freddie came out here and Buddy started putting his new band together. But he had the foresight to see how you would use your body to follow and motivate the bounce of the stick and bring up some of the uniquenesses in Buddy's playing. And then the great thing that he had, which is what I think, you know, you guys I'm hearing is how he influenced your life, was just the musicianship of how that can all flow and make you be a creative person and be, you know, the legendary drummers that you are today. Totally unique person at every level of his life. I've got about a 2-hour interview with him that's up on the website, on the Drum Channel website, where I kind of tried to reminisce through some of the stories that I'd heard that had happened to him personally, and then some of his experiences with Buddy too. But nobody ever like him before. Nobody ever like him coming up again.
All right. Well, that's the end of part one of our tribute to Freddie Gruber, remembering Freddie Gruber. Stay tuned for part two. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave a comment, and we'll see you real soon. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. See ya. Hey, everybody. John DeChristopher here, and I want to thank you for watching and listening to Live from My Drum Room. I started this show in April of 2020, and it's now 4 years and almost 200 episodes later, and I'm excited to tell you about my new Live from My Drum Room t-shirts. In fact, I'm wearing one right now. Made of 60% cotton, 40% polyester, a really soft cotton blend. I'm wearing a size medium, and you can have yours for $25, including shipping, in the contiguous U.S. I will give you my Venmo information, which I'll also include in the description. There's my Venmo information, and you can email me at livefrommydrumroom@gmail.com with any questions, and that will also be in the description. So get your shirt while they last. They're available in extra small to double XL. I do have limited quantities of the extra smalls and the double XLs, but plenty of everything else. So once again, thanks for watching, thanks for listening, thanks for subscribing, and don't forget to pick up your Live from My Drum Room t-shirt. See you soon. And remember, no drummers are harmed on any show. All right, well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms, so download it. And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live from My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right. Again, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you again real soon. See ya.